The Unlovely Truth discusses subjects that may be upsetting to young or sensitive listeners. Please use discretion. When you hear the words massacre or genocide, what do you think of? The death camps of the Nazis? The ethnic cleansing in Rwanda? Or maybe the killing fields of Cambodia? Both of these words were used by author E.R. Bills in his book, The 1910 Slocum Massacre, to describe the events of the last few days in July 1910 in and around Slocum, Texas. Official records only attribute roughly 5 deaths, but historians and descendants put the number at or surpassing 100. A local sheriff at the time was quoted as saying, "Men were going about killing Negroes as fast as they could find them, and so far as I was able to ascertain, without any real cause. These Negroes have done no wrong that I could discover. There was just a hot-headed gang hunting them down and killing them." Welcome to episode 11 of The Unlovely Truth. The call came in to Anderson County, Texas Sheriff William Black in Palestine around 11 p.m. on July 29th of 1910. The sheriff from neighboring Houston County, John Lacey, said that a white man had killed 2 black men and he wanted some backup when he made the arrest. He wasn't so sure people would agree that arresting a white man for such a crime was really necessary. Sheriff Black said he was busy, but he could come if absolutely necessary. Sheriff Lacey said that he would deal with the situation himself. He called back an hour later, saying that he had determined that the murders had actually taken place just over the Anderson County line. 2 deputies were sent, and then Sheriff Black followed the next morning. By the time he arrived, armed mobs were roaming the streets. No one really knew what started the violence. Some said that a black business owner was trying to cheat a white farmer over a debt. Others were supposedly angry that a local African-American man had been put in charge of a road project, managing white workers. Rumors were also spreading that the black community was planning an uprising to kill all of the local whites. Years later, there would be darker speculation that the violence was all a pretext by whites to frighten black citizens into abandoning their homes and properties. Properties that some local whites wanted for themselves. As groups of roving white men shot at any blacks they could find, that is exactly what happened. Many African Americans fled into the woods, were pursued there, and killed as they ran away. There were more deaths on Saturday, the 30th of July. Most of Slocum's white women and children were holed up in churches and schoolhouses guarded by armed men. The mobs had cut the town's phone lines, and they swept through black settlements, shooting at anyone they saw. The Texas Rangers and the state militia were called upon to help restore order. Sheriff Black estimated that the mob responsible for the violence numbered at least 200, and they were having difficulty determining exactly how many people had been killed. Earlier that same month, for the first time ever, a black man named Jack Johnson had won the world heavyweight boxing title, defeating Bob Fitzsimmons. As soon as the fight was over, there were riots by whites all across the nation and violence against blacks. None was reported in Slocum, Texas. But when the dust had settled after the later killings, local papers could not agree on the number of dead nor the details of who was responsible. They called the incident a race riot, as though both sides were equally at fault. One newspaper in Abilene actually printed, quote, "Whites gathered arms and went coon hunting," end quote. In the days that followed the massacre, some whites began to publicly state that the blacks who had been targeted had done nothing wrong. On July 31st, the Texas Rangers arrested 3 men. A grand jury was convened on August 1st, and the judge admirably instructed them in the law that they had sworn to uphold. On August 2nd, 4 more arrests were made, and by August 14th, 3 more. Then on August 17th, the grand jury returned murder indictments against 7 white men. But then time passed. The proceedings were moved to a different venue, which slowed things down. A new prosecutor and a new governor were elected, which slowed things down even more. And in the end, no one was ever prosecuted for these crimes.
Well, I'm joined this week by Jill McCracken. She has a wealth of experience in topics that we're going to be covering today. So I'm going to let her share all of that with you. Thanks for joining us, Jill.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Lori.
So tell me, I know you're a history teacher, and I know you've done some election monitoring. So tell me, you know, exactly what all that has been for you.
I started out as teaching history as well as psychology. And instead of just being content to teach lessons about places that I haven't been to, I became interested in going to the places and bringing back information to my students. And that's kind of what started me going elsewhere. The big kicker was when I traveled to Israel. We can get into that in more detail. But it subsequently, on my return from Israel, I went to a conference where I was going to be telling about my experiences there. And I wind up sitting next to this woman who was there to talk about election monitoring. And I didn't have any idea what she was talking about. And she says, oh, yes, you know, I work with the State Department. And we're always looking for people, good people, who go and represent the United States in monitoring other countries that are developing democracy. And I was like, oh, hi,
I'm in.
My new best friend in the world. Hi, Leslie. And, you know, we got talking as we spent 6 hours sitting next to each other at this conference. And she heard my story. I heard her story. And she's like, you're perfect for what I need to do. You need to fill out an application. And she says, then I'll be in touch. And I did. I went home. I filled out the application. And I honestly didn't give it too much more thought. And I get this phone call. And she's like, hey, Jill, it's Leslie. It's like, Leslie, it's so nice. How are you? And everything. We're talking and chatting. She says, Jill, do you realize this is the phone call? And I said, what phone call? She goes, I want you to do an election mission. I was just flabbergasted. And this is what started what I mean by election missioning. I go to countries like Kyrgyzstan, Armenia, Belarus, Ukraine, and with my colleagues who are some Americans, but from all over Europe and Central Asia, NATO countries as well. We are partnered up. We're sent to a region in the country, and we simply observe them conducting their election. And it's a very streamlined procedure. We are not there to interfere. We just observe how well they are following their own rules and regulations. The catch is you have to learn their rules and their regulations, and you have a very finite period to learn that. It is really a lot of fun. It is intensely grueling. Election day, you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're at the polling station before they are because you have to witness the opening and if there's any shenanigans going on prior. And when the polling station closes, you are there for the count. And I think we're starting in this country to have a little bit of idea that the counting of the ballots can have snags. Yes, we're starting to get it, yeah, but this has been going on in other countries for a while, and our experience with paper ballots are limited, but we're starting to realize their importance as backup, and this can go on, you know, till all hours of the night. The longest event I was involved with was when I was on something called the B team, and we didn't actually get there at first thing in the morning. We came on later in the afternoon. Because we were going to go literally all through the process of counting, bringing all of the ballots from all of the local areas back to the what would be like the county seat, and from them to the Capitol. So we're involved in the whole, you know, second part of the process. And there was a computer glitch. The app didn't work.
Oh, no. Are you kidding?
No, I'm not. The app didn't work. There was a little problem in the computer program. And when they went to fill in the information on numbers of ballots and what had been, they had inverted it on the paper that they were now putting into the computer, and it wouldn't take the information. So by polling station closed 9 o'clock in the evening, and by 10 o'clock in the morning, out of, you know, 128 polling stations, 15 had been recorded.
Oh my.
And we were still there.
So very timely.
We're still there.
To have you sharing with us. And I know in talking with you before, I'm so fascinated with your experience in these foreign countries where there has been a lot of conflict and even some areas with a history of ethnic cleansing.
That as well.
So I immediately thought of you when I read this book, because I know myself, I'm a bit of a history buff. And so when I think of ethnic cleansing, pogroms, any kind of thing like that, I always think about it being somewhere in a foreign country. And so it fascinated me that this author was posing the idea that this has happened in America. It looks a little different. It's perhaps on a smaller scale. But, you know, here we have a situation in Texas back in 1910, mm-hmm. where a series of perhaps miscommunications of just some tension between people with money, people without money, Black community, white community. Somehow it all fomented into what the newspapers at the time even called a race riot.
Indeed, yeah.
And so, you know, I just wanted to talk with you about the concept of otherness. I think that was a big thing here when you had these tensions between Black community and white community. It wasn't a community of the town.
It no. was,
this is me and everyone else is an other.
An expression you might hear is the other side of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
That's their part of town. And then there's our part of town.
How much of that did you see when you were in these other countries?
Quite a bit. In the United States, we hear a lot about Black versus white. The idea of otherness, though, is human. It is not one of our most appealing attributes. But we psychologically are programmed to actually divide ourselves this way. And it's a survival instinct in us. It goes back to, you know, ancient man, to literally us coming out of the trees and standing up as bipedal creatures. That is, you wanting to survive, you had to be able to identify who are my people and who aren't. So it's kind of a built-in mechanism. And that's why we haven't been able to teach prejudice away. You would think you'd teach it once and then we'd get it and be done with. But that's unfortunately not how it works. Every generation has to be taught, because it's kind of that's dividing us up into these people are safe and these people are different is kind of hot-wired into us.
When I hear that heart of an educator coming through. And that was something I wanted to talk about, because, you know, when you look at the roots of this particular incident in Slocum, there were a lot of different theories as to why things happened. Fear was one of them. People are going to have to hurt. These people are planning to hurt me, so I'm going to hurt them first. There was just the idea of hatred, the
Absolutely.
I'm better than you. And I was fascinated with the thought of greed. If I can run you off, I can have your things.
Oh, absolutely. There can be a very big socioeconomic component to it. If you go back to the Salem witch trials, if you wanted a piece of land to expand your farm and your neighbor's an old widow, all you had to do was say, she looked at my cow and my calf died and she's a witch. And you could get that property really cheap. I mean, there's an economic component to many of these kinds of events.
And did you see that in some of these other countries too, where they were having conflicts around the voting? What kind of conflicts were you sensing?
The very first election that I went to was in Croatia. And it wasn't so much conflict about the people, but this is coming now after all of the conflict and ethnic cleansing that had gone on is the former Soviet, of the former socialist country, Yugoslavia, was breaking down. And you have Croatia now being a separate country. So we're now going there to watch and see how they're doing, developing democracy. And we look at the voting record, and everybody is listed with their ethnicity.
Really?
Yes.
Here's as far as being like a Serb?
Right. You're here, this person is Croatian, this person is Serbian, this person's Albanian, this person is Hungarian, this person is, and so on and so on down the line. And one of our recommendations was that, hey, you may want to eliminate that. It's not necessary for people to, you know, sign the voter registry, identify themselves as a voter, and go vote. And they did do that, by the way. That was implemented, and that is no longer a part of how the election was conducted. But it makes you stop and you realize how deeply ingrained this can be.
Oh, now, sure.
Now, this is 7 years after the conflict. So we're taking baby steps here in the name of developing a more democratic and plurality in society. But they listened, they took that suggestion and improved upon their election, saying, yes, of course. Because that's why these elections are important.
Did you see any efforts to keep anybody from voting? You know, as a student of American history, you think about the laws that where somebody had to own a certain amount of property or this or that. And it was often aimed at keeping certain segments from being able to vote.
Where that would come into play had to do with people who were criminals. It came into play where homes had been destroyed or burned, which was also true in Croatia, was also true in Kosovo. Homes had been destroyed. People came back, literally had no identification papers, couldn't necessarily prove that they owned property. And yet they're trying to register to vote. Where do you live? Well, I used to live here and I think it's still my property. I don't have any paperwork to prove it. But if I can find somebody I used to know in the village that may not even be there anymore, I might be able to have someone back up what I'm saying. So after conflict and war like that, it became really hard to prove who you are, where you lived, to register to vote.
Oh, sure. And so
this is in a modern society. This is 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Where we're trying to sort all of these things out compared to back in, you know, the 20th century, dealing with conflicts then.
Now, you mentioned traveling to Israel. You know, obviously,
that's a story. I hope you're ready for that one.
There's been conflict there since Israel began and before. So I'm very interested to hear, you know, what your impressions were when you visited there. Again, back to that concept of otherness.
Well, it was a country that I was very comfortable in. And I think if there was a country that I could go live in, it would be Israel.
Really?
Yes. Because there is such a respect for rule of law and rights.
Nice.
Highly sensitive to people's rights. Probably because they're so often criticized about not caring for people's rights. That was the impression that that I got. However, when you go into a grocery store, you're searched. I was not ready for that because, you know, we're going to be there for a while. We're buying water. We're traveling, going places. So you buy water. And I was searched to go to the grocery store. This is before 9/11 now, where we get searched now to go into many different venues, but I'm still not searched going into my grocery store.
Right.
I mean, my mouth must have been hanging open. He says, it's for your security. And I said, yes, and thank you. Please search away, which is still my response. Even at the airport, some people get annoyed. And I'm like, I love you. Search. Do what you need to do. That's another story about, I'll tell you about my airplane story if we have time.
All right. I'm sure the TSA loves you.
Oh, they do. They really do. Israel, too. We did get to some of the Palestinian areas. I did get to Nazareth and Bethlehem. And there is a different climate. But again, I was welcomed with open arms. I never felt threatened. It was just a different sense of they were warm, welcoming, eager, a little bit more standoffish, even with the hospitality that they were expressing.
Okay.
At least towards me and as an American, I think.
Did you feel like other members of your team from other countries, could you tell, did they feel that same warmth, or do you think it was because Israel and America have had such close ties?
I think it was that, but I should clarify here. I was there studying. I wasn't doing an election mission at this point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was studying Holocaust. I'm on top of everything else. I'm a Holocaust and genocide teacher.
Okay, so well, that's
what I was doing in Israel at that time. But I was with a lot of other international teachers and a good number of Americans. Because, see, teachers don't spend the summer sitting around at the pool. We study.
Well, and I think that experience, again, plays right into the themes brought out by this massacre at Slocum.
Absolutely.
And, you know, being a person of faith and that being part of my podcast, I was reminded of Galatians 3:28, where it says, there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free, there's neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And it amazed me that a lot of the people that were involved as the aggressors in this very unfortunate event were described as God-fearing, church-going, religious folk. And yet they let that otherness dominate their thoughts in a way that is not a part of Christian teaching at all. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Jewish faith, they are traditionally very welcoming of people from outside their faith. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, did you feel that, I would think it would be very easy with their history to be very bitter and to have a victim mentality. Did you feel that from them, or were they just willing to take people at face value and start a relationship?
I have to say, again, every individual deals with their history in their own way. I was in Israel for a month, and every Friday night I went to Orthodox services. I'm a Catholic and was welcomed. No one batted an eye to see this Catholic coming in with big eyes, not knowing what I was supposed to be doing. But I wanted to know. I was there to learn and was welcomed. I also went to mosque and was figuring that out. And then I went to Catholic service. I've never been in so many religious houses in my life, but I wanted, here I was where the three great religions were born. I wanted it all. It was a marvelous experience, which wound up really changing my life totally.
Well, I know you have a fabulous story from that time, and I want to make sure that that I give you plenty of time to share that with us. And I'm just excited to hear it again. So I'll let you take over.
This trip to Israel was something I had wanted to do for quite some time. And if people remember back to 1999, there was the air war going on over Kosovo. Serbia was conducting ethnic cleansing against Kosovar Albanian Muslims. Serbians are mostly, for the most part, Eastern Orthodox Christians, and Slobodan Milosevic was using his machine of war to drive them out of Kosovo. And this had been going on. The United States and NATO intervened. There was an air war and bombings that went on. Refugees fled the country. It was a really terrible, terrible time for people. And I had been watching all of this as I was planning my trip the following summer to Israel to go study the Holocaust. And I got this idea in my head that I should stop in Kosovo on the way home. Because if you look geographically, it's in Southern Europe, and I'd literally be flying right over it on the way home. And I said, well, how does one go to a country that is technically a combat zone and occupied by NATO troops? How do you
as one does,
as one asks when you're preparing to, you know, fly to a combat zone? So I emailed NATO, and I actually got a response from a wonderful Norwegian major who was like, "You want to do what?" And I said, well, I'm a teacher and I teach the Holocaust and I'm going to be studying in Israel and I literally want to stop in on the way home. And I explained that basically I wanted to bear witness for my students. I wanted to walk. I didn't want to just talk the talk. I wanted to walk the walk. I wanted to walk the grounds. If I was studying the Holocaust from 60 years hindsight, this happened not even a year ago. I wanted to be there and talk to the people. And he said, well, yeah, you can. You can't fly into Kosovo. It's occupied by the Russian troops who aren't really thrilled with us. So you'll have to fly into Macedonia, bring Deutschmarks. That's the currency. It's like, oh, okay. Deutschmark, German. Okay. So all of this is going through my head. And I just, you know, tell my family, oh, I'm going to be stopping in Kosovo. And they look at me and they're like, you're going to what? And isn't that like military occupied? Yeah. Like, aren't there still bombings and things? Well, yeah.
But what? NATO said I could.
But NATO said I could. You know, in hindsight, it was complete madness. But I was just absolutely determined that this is what I was going to do. So now that I'm going to do this, I think, well, gee, most of the population's Albanian. I should learn to speak Albanian, or at least, you know, be able to, you know, communicate somewhat. You know, where's the bathroom? Kundot banja. I still say that. So during this conflict, New Jersey at Fort Dix had taken in 5,000 Kosovar Albanian refugees. So I networked around, which is, you know, this is still, you know, the year 2000. So the internet is kind of working, but not like we have today, believe me. And I got in touch with a young man named Gentian. And he had now gone from Fort Dix to Staten Island, where he had some cousins. And he agreed to practice with me. So we were on the phone, landlines, not cell phones. And he would laugh with me. I'd say things like, the bathroom's on fire, instead of where's the bathroom. And there's certain words you can't say, syllables and put together and things. So we'd laugh. And when it got to the point where I was like, really, I'm leaving and packing bags, he says, you're really going to do this? And I said, yes. And he says, then you have to find my mother. And all of a sudden things got very serious, but I'm like, what? You have to find my mother. The last thing she heard, I was running, Serbian troops were chasing me. She doesn't know if I'm dead or alive. You have to find my mother. And now I'm blinking my eyes 100 times a minute and saying, Gentian, how am I going to find your mother? I don't know where I'm going to be. I mean, how am I going to do this? And he says, well, I know you're going to be in the capital, Pristina, and you will find my best friend, Fitim Zara. And he will take you to Jakova, and he will take you to my mother, and you will find my mother, and you will tell her I'm alive. And I said, Fitim Zara, Fitim Zara. I'm like, Jakova is a city, it's a town. It's a little town. It's a village. And I'm sure. I said, well, all right, sure. I'm going to find Fee Team and I'm going to find your mother. He said, when we have to meet, because I have some things you have to give my mother for me. So I go to Staten Island. I meet Gentian. He gives me a pair of shoes and black hair dye. And I'm like, Gentian, you're such a sweet, but you're such a guy. I said, come here. And I take his photograph. A mother is going to want a photograph. I mean, yes, your mother might be a little on the vain side. I mean, we all get our hair done and all, but she's going to want a photograph. So I agree to do this thing. And to show you how close it was, I literally had the photograph. This is old-fashioned film developed in Jerusalem. That's how closely timed this was. So the whole time that I'm now in Jerusalem studying at Yad Vashem with the Holocaust teachers and from all over the world, in the back of my mind, I'm really nervous. I'm like, how am I going to find this woman? How am I going to find Fee Team? Oh, my goodness. So we're there about 3.5 weeks now, and the Kosovo part is coming up, and we had a day off, and we're touristing around. I think we were at King David's Tower, and we stop in this little nothing of a place to have some beer and hummus and pita bread. And one of the Austrian teachers says to me, Jill, I heard you're doing something crazy. You're going to Kosovo next week. And I said, yes, I am going to Kosovo next week. And I feel this tap on my shoulder. And I look over and there's an Israeli couple, Mr. and Mrs. sitting next to me. And they said, I'm sorry, we don't mean to interrupt. Did you just say you were going to Kosovo? And I said, yes, next week I'm going. We're going to Kosovo. Now, Lori, this is not the tourist capital, okay? I'm not kidding you. This is military occupation. So my jaw drops and I'm like, oh my gosh. I said, I'm going to study, ethnic cleansing. Why are you going to Kosovo? So they say to me, well, Israel will do whatever is necessary to stop ethnic cleansing and genocide. We have a history. It is our duty to do this. I said, well, of course. And they said, and most of the refugees that were coming out are Muslims. And if Israel can do something to help Muslims, we're going to do this. So we took in 1,000 refugees, which I was not aware of any of this.
No, and never heard of that either.
Well, Israel did. They took in 1,000 Muslim refugees from Kosovo. And she says, we took in a young man. I'm getting upset again. They took in a young man. And I just knew, Lori, I just looked at them and I said, and his name is Fee Team Zara.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm starting to shake. She looked at me. She says, oh, my God, you know Fee Team. I said, no, I don't. But you do. The Fee Team Zara that I have to find so I can bring Gentian's mother this message is the adoptive Israeli son of this couple that's sitting next to me.
See, I don't know how anybody could say there's no God when stuff like that happens.
No, I don't call it whatever you want. But to me, I said that is the hand of God.
Agreed.
That they took this Roman Catholic American. They took this Albanian Muslim family. They took this Jewish family in Israel. This is three continents, Asia, Europe, and America, North America. They got all of us together to put that one mother out of her misery of not knowing what happened to her son.
Oh, I'm getting chills. I love stories like this. That is so amazing.
It is the most profound, soul-shaking event, occurrence. It took me so long to process all of this. And they were absolutely right. We wind up, there were very few hotels in Kosovo at the time. Most of them were occupied by journalists and people who were there for aid work, humanitarian aid work. And we wind up staying at the Park Hotel, which had a park. And here I am with the Shrivers. And I'm sitting there with Gentian's picture and the shoes and the hair dye. And Fee Team comes over and he's looking and hugging them. And he's like, who is this woman sitting with them? And he sees the picture of Gentian. He's like, oh my God, that's Gentian. Where's Gentian? And we tell him this whole story. And he's like, oh my God. Oh my God. And you ran, where were you? I said, I don't know. We were in just some pub somewhere and ran into each other. And I give him the shoes, the picture, the everything. He does go to Jakova. He goes in, he tells Gentian's mom that he is fine, he's alive. She drops on her knees thanking Allah that her son is alive. And I realized later, I was not in Kosovo to study ethnic cleansing or to bear witness and all of this for my students. I was there to deliver that message to that woman. That was really why I was there. And that is pretty profound. Because believe me, my family, I've made this sound very smooth. It was not. My family was highly resistant to this. Very, very didn't want me to go. Very much.
I can imagine. But what a testimony you have to how much God cares for every person on this earth.
Yep. That message was sent to that woman. Now, I did not get to meet her. Another complete happenstance, I wound up embedded with the U.S. Army.
Of course you did, Jill. Of course I did.
And I mean, I was in Mother Teresa's church where she grew up. She was Kosovar Albanian. Nobody really realized that, but there are Kosovar Albanian Catholics. So I was at her church and went to an Albanian wedding on top of a roof where we got stuck with the Humvees and couldn't get down the mountain and danced at the wedding in my Kevlar and flak vest. I could tell you stories you wouldn't believe, but the message got to Gentian's mom.
That is awesome. And for everyone listening who has loved listening to Jill, you will be so excited to hear that Jill has her own podcast. So yes. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I've always had a love for true crime and mysteries.
Which is how we met.
Yes, absolutely. So I've had a true crime book club for years. And a good friend of mine, Tara, and I decided to take it to a podcast. So the Murder Shelf Book Club came into existence, and we pull a book off our murder shelf. We realized that since we've been reading all these books for years, we have this horrible library of serial killer, death. And every time a repairman comes in the house or we have a Christmas party, people are standing there and they're drinking and they look and they go, oh my God, what is that? Oh, that's just my murder shelf. Don't worry. It really does. So Murder Shelf is the perfect name for it.
I'd say. And,
right? Everybody in true crime gets it because they all have murder shelves too, because a lot of us read. And we pull a book off. We try to present the author's perspective on the story. I do a lot of the psychology analysis, since I spent 30 years teaching psychology. Mm-hmm. And you spend a lot of time, even though you're a history teacher, psychoanalyzing the parents and the students. I do a lot of that. I've actually become a pretty good profiler, if I do say myself. my private investigator friends can probably verify that for me. And Tara has a background in criminology. So we analyze the cases, and then we talk about, you know, the crimes that were committed and try to keep it as respectful as we can for the victims and their families.
Of course, that is so important, because not everyone does that.
No, that is absolutely key. I will admit we do have a bit of a gallows sense of humor. I found with teaching the Holocaust and the genocide, if you don't keep some kind of sense of humor about what you're doing, you know, you really have to, because you can get
overwhelmed
by that darkness. And the same can happen in true crime. So forgive me if I get a little raw in my humor sometimes, but it's kind of a necessary shielding to keep you going forward.
Well, I want everyone to look on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, just all the major players, wherever you find your podcasts, look for the Murder Shelf Book Club. And don't forget to come back next week when we're going to have Jill with us again discussing the aftermath of the Slocum Massacre. So thanks for being with us, Jill.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Look forward to talking to you next week.
Great, Lori. Thank you.
Be sure to join me next week for the second part of this story. We'll explore the immediate after effects and the ones that have lingered to this day. And I hope everyone is taking precautions to keep themselves and their loved ones safe during this coronavirus pandemic. and watching out for friends and neighbors who need your help. It's time to put others' needs ahead of our own and care for each other as we would want to be cared for. The Unlovely Truth is written and produced by me, Lori Morrison. Music is by Neo Cortex, and the artwork is by Shelby Morrison. Thanks to my special guest, Jill McCracken. And as always, my listeners get my biggest thanks. Please download the podcast and help it keep growing by sharing it with your friends. You can find it on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, Spotify, and other places where your favorite podcasts are found. And please check out my website at theunlovelytruth.com. You can find resources and sign up for email reminders when new episodes drop. You can also find information about the podcast on Facebook and Instagram, so be sure to check that out. See you next time.